Spirit of life and love, whom we know by many names, we give thanks for this opportunity to be reminded of all that connects us to one another and connects us to all life. We think with care of those who are suffering. We celebrate together in joy with those little victories that we share with one another. We give thanks for all of the blessings in our lives, little and big. And we give thanks as well for this moment when we can be together, called out of our individual lives, and can hold up as a community these values that we cherish. For all these blessings, we are grateful. Blessed be, and amen. Our reading this morning is from the book Money and the Meaning of Life by Jacob Needleman, and I'll speak a little further in the sermon about the importance of this reading for me. Needleman writes, "There had once existed civilizations, whole worlds, which had not wanted what we in our world have called wealth. Certainly, humanity has always needed and craved material things. But not every culture or civilization has measured itself principally by this standard of comfort and safety in the material world. We live, then, in a wealthy country, what nowadays has been called an affluent society. This means not only that we have much material wealth, but that we want this wealth more than we want anything else. This ordering of priorities has brought our civilization to the brink of ruin. We need to understand that when the great thinkers of the past warned us about the evils of our desires, they are speaking of addiction, in which obtaining the apparent object of our desires serves only to intensify the desire itself. No great teacher, neither Jesus nor Moses nor Socrates, ever condemned desire in itself. What they tried to show us is that we allow these desires to define our sense of identity. In the first part of Dante's Divine Comedy, the author descends into hell and begins feeling pity for the men and women he sees there, writhing in filth and pain. But his guide, the great poet Virgil, admonishes him. "Do not feel pity," he says. "They are getting exactly what they want." Hell is the state in which we are barred from receiving what we truly need because of the value we give to what we merely want. In the sea of information and activity that we live in, it's so easy to be sidetracked from what is most important to us, to let the constant demand for more distort how we experience our lives. I can't remember a time when I've heard more people protesting that there won't be enough for them and people like them. Enough wealth, enough time, enough freedom. Our fear takes the form of complaints that increased access to health care is described as robbing the more deserving of their entitlements, that same-sex marriage is criticized as stealing the dignity from heterosexual marriages, that the plans for a Muslim community center in New York City somehow attack the sacredness of the Twin Towers site. While some of this is clearly manufactured drama, I believe that there is also a real and widespread foundation of anxiety about whether we will have enough, whether we will have what we need. Lewis Lapham writes in his book, Money and Class in America, Never in the history of the world have so many people been so rich. Never in the history of the world have so many of those same people felt themselves so poor. We live in the midst of so much affluence in the form of safety, comfort, and pleasure, and yet we as a nation are nonetheless wretchedly unfulfilled and insecure. Unitarian Universalist scholar and minister, the Reverend Tandeka, speaks of the paradox of middle-class poverty. And I know from her audience's response that these observations strike a chord with many who consider themselves among the middle class. She observes, they live in houses they can't afford, drive cars they don't own, and wear clothes they've bought on credit. Worse yet, toward the end of each pay period, many have to use their charge cards to buy food. This late 20th century phenomenon has crippled the American soul. Despite the objective reality that ever more of us live in abundance, especially when considered from a global perspective, we are increasingly trapped in the mindset that it will never be enough. This morning's sermon is not going to be a megachurch message about how the right beliefs will result in God showering you with riches, or about how a New Age wish fulfillment spirituality will magically surround you with everything you desire. What I hope to do during our time together is offer some new ways in which we might understand abundance and feel our fear loosening into a more generous spirit. I was lucky enough during my seminary studies to receive some very useful education about the subjects of generosity and abundance. In particular, I had arranged a tutorial with Professor Alicia Forsey to test an experimental course that she was developing called Building a Theology of Money. As far as I know, Star King School was the only seminary at the time to offer such a course, in which students could explore the emotional baggage that money carries, reflect on its theological meaning, and strategize about how to talk with congregations as we develop a healthier culture around church finances. Using the book from which this morning's reading was taken, Money and the Meaning of Life, Alicia and I explored the concept of stewardship, a deeper understanding of the meaning that our possessions represent, and striving to give back to the world in ways that reflect our deepest values. I did an inventory of all of my belongings, reflected on why each of those possessions was important to me, and decided whether it had a continued place in my life. Through all of our reading and discussion together, we returned again and again to the message that, in addition to the numbers in our bank accounts, there is also a subjective dimension to whether we have enough. As straightforward a task as it is to calculate how much we need to pay the bills from month to month, we also have intangible needs, including what it takes to make us feel that we have enough. In coming to understand how congregations handle their resources, I came to realize that the perception of scarcity or abundance is perhaps just as critical as the reality. One of the most important lessons in my tutorial was the distinction between a philosophy of scarcity and a philosophy of abundance. I've been impressed to see it played out again and again that how we think about abundance influences our perception of whether we have enough and how well we're able to enjoy it. A philosophy of scarcity is not only about seeing the glass as half empty, but feeling that even if the glass were full, that it could not be enough. Congregations that are dominated by a philosophy of scarcity tend to reveal it whenever they talk about the offering or the annual campaign as unpleasant drudgery, saying, we know that you hate to talk about money, and we're really sorry. And this is how much we need to just barely get by, and we really wish we didn't have to do this. And the result is nearly always a miserable outcome, both in the terms of the amount collected and the feeling that everyone is left with. On the other hand, a philosophy of abundance conveys a belief that we will find a way to have enough. Congregations that work from this philosophy are intentional about how their values and their desires match up, and then work to achieve them with language like, "And these are the exciting things that we've been able to do because of your generosity. And we hope that you'll help us follow through on all of these great plans that we have." That's a big difference, isn't it? Most impressively, what I've realized is that a community can learn to change its stance toward scarcity and cultivate that culture, that philosophy of abundance. As useful as my education has been for congregational fundraising, I think that it's been even more valuable in understanding how we experience our needs as individuals. You may have heard of the work of American psychologist Abraham Maslow, who explained human motivations with his theory of the hierarchy of needs. In this model, our higher needs are built upon our more basic biological needs, such as food, water, shelter, and safety. And unless the foundation of these most basic needs is first met, we can't give our full attention to the qualities that make our lives meaningful. That is, as long as people are unsafe, underfed, or deprived of some other basic need, their relationships and their spiritual growth will remain stunted or distorted. Another important experience during my years in seminary gave me the opportunity to reflect quite a bit, personally, on these issues. Even though I had been working half-time throughout my seminary studies and borrowing the maximum amount of student loans allowed every semester, I became unable to pay up front the next semester's rent for my room in the Episcopalian Seminary's dormitory, and I was evicted. Deeply embarrassed for not being able to provide for my own basic needs, I kept this a secret from my school and from my classmates and lived a shadow life behind my public life. I had been working as Star King's custodian, and I had keys to everything, so I was able to store my possessions in a dark corner of the school archives. And every night, after all of my classmates had left the building and I locked up, I bedded down on the floor in the basement bathroom, one of the few rooms that I could lock for some sense of privacy. Every morning, I rose early before anyone else arrived, washed out of the sink, and packed away my sleeping bag before anyone else could see. Although I continued to attend classes and my training as a hospital chaplain, I found that Maslow had hit the nail on the head. My continuing anxiety about keeping a place to live effectively shut down every one of my other abilities. It seemed that my heart clenched every time a panhandler asked me for change, and even the smallest acts of generosity seemed more than I could manage that semester. In the years since, my finances have been much more secure, even to the point of buying a house during my first ministry. But I found that beyond a certain point, more possessions did not bring me a greater sense of security or feelings of wealth. And I've read studies about happiness that confirm this. A British economist named Andrew Oswald surveyed levels of happiness in different cultures and at different levels of wealth, and concluded that rich nations are not generally happier than poor nations, and rich people are not generally happier than poor people. Once those most basic needs for food, clothing, shelter, and safety are met, he said, more wealth brings only minor changes in happiness. This is why in Western industrial nations, We've experienced long-term increases in prosperity without a comparable increase in our satisfaction. Needleman agrees that having more doesn't change how we feel inside, saying, if you're a worrier when you're poor, you're going to be a worrier when you're rich. Real change has to start from within us, because the consequences of a clenched heart are far-reaching, I've found. A philosophy of scarcity tells us that there's never enough, and so we hang on to what little we have. We protect it, and perhaps even hoard more in case there will be a shortage. Even if we know that others are doing without, our most basic impulse is to guarantee that we and ours have enough first. Because social generosity becomes possible only when we feel that we have enough to spare, it's nearly unthinkable to have a safety net for the poor and the vulnerable when we are trapped in the middle of an attitude of scarcity. I think about my own tight-fistedness when I was afraid that there wouldn't be enough. And I imagine those feelings of stinginess multiplied by millions and the consequences to our society. The conventional view is that wealth is a finite resource. Every bit that is added to it results in that much more, and every bit that is taken away from it gives us that much less. At some level, of course, this is true. Saving and spending resources like money and time are simple arithmetic. But there's something more. Don't you know people who, despite their apparent abundance, never seem happy, never seem to have enough? And don't you also know people who seem to be genuinely satisfied with whatever little they have? The difference is not in the figures in their bank account or the number of open spaces in their schedule, but it's their perception of whether they have what they need. But how do we change our perception then of what is enough? How do we shift our views about what really matters in our lives? Perhaps you won't be surprised to hear from me that the greatest relief from my feelings of scarcity came for me in religious community. Between seminary and settling in with my first congregation in Michigan, I spent 2 years in Transylvania as the English teacher in the Unitarian Seminary there. Despite what we might consider a third world standard of living in Romania, I found the Transylvanians generally more satisfied with what they had than we are. Despite many villagers spending long hours eking out a subsistence from the fields, I also found them more inclined to handle their time with a sense of abundance, rather than allowing their lives to be driven by an arbitrary schedule. Their Unitarian faith is the experience of strong roots and a deep well, which has sustained them through many, many decades of hardship and has shaped them to be, in the midst of so little, the most generous and hospitable people that I've ever met. The gift I received from the Transylvanian Unitarians is the lesson that we heal chronic scarcity with gratitude. Epicurus wrote the quote at the top of our order of service that it is not what we possess, but what we enjoy that constitutes our abundance. That enjoyment comes in the form of gratitude for the gifts in our life, even as we struggle to turn away from the toxic messages that there must be more, always more. For most of us, the answer to feelings of spiritual poverty, to wretched emotional scarcity, is not in consuming more or hoarding more, but in finding new appreciation for what we already have. I believe that as feelings of scarcity and insecurity bedevil our country, this religious community can be a place that embodies abundance and gratitude for its members and friends. This building can offer a refuge from that barrage of messages out there that tries to convince us of our incompleteness and our inadequacy. This can be a place where we and our children learn to live in gratitude for every small gift, including the gift of one another. This is done in small ways, such as not nickel and diming people for little things like refreshments after the service, creating an atmosphere of hospitality, but also in greater ways, like providing the space and resources that your community needs to remain a home for intellectual integrity and moral courage. Cultivating a philosophy of abundance is not simply about getting members to give more to the church, but to give thanks more. And in doing so, shaping this community to be a place where gratitude becomes as natural as breathing. May this message of thankfulness be the legacy that we leave to our children, that they too will know the abundance of love and life that we have found here. May it be so.